Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Dear Blood River Radio family, thank you so much for hanging on. We have a new guy, Paul Brown. We're going to bring him in a few minutes. But right now, if you, everybody and his mama knows, third hour, is as long as there's Blood River Radio, it's the third hour will always be the bitter ender hour. Yes, as long as Blood River Radio exists, he's our expert on the our second war of independence, and we tried to extricate the South from that satanic union. Should I say satanic union? That glorious union that is led by Satan himself. Anyway, Bitter Ender, how you doing tonight, brother?
Doing very well. Doing very well. We've actually got electricity back on this week, so things are a lot better here in Muzak City. So. Doing a lot better.
Well, I'll tell you what, it did amazing how we take things for granted like that.
Oh, my gosh. Isn't that the truth?
I got to tell you a quick tale. We've been having trouble with our hot water heater. And our feet, I'm not as, my hygiene suffers according to what the ladies tell me. I don't take enough baths, et cetera, et cetera. But I was telling them, I'll make this quick. My grandparents on the mother's side grew up. They came down from the Ozark Mountains of Arkansas in 1929. In case anybody recognizes that year, that was the year the stock market crashed. They came down and created the greatest depression the United States had ever known. They came down from the Ozark Mountains of Arkansas to the Delta, the Mississippi River, St. Francis River Delta in Arkansas, and they lived in a house. It was more like a chicken house. You could see through the floors, no insulation. No plumbing, no outdoor plumbing. And these people took precious few baths compared to the way people nowadays think about baths. They had to heat their water in a big iron, cast iron pot outside. A spring was usually the time for baths. I had an uncle tell me that they'd get a haircut maybe once a year or so. He said the old barber couldn't cut that rust off his back. He'd have a chisel to cut that old rust off his back. And he said they'd take a bath. Every spring you took baths. So we take so many things for granted nowadays, and we're so daggum spoiled. And that's, I'm talking about, that was in right before my lifetime. They were sharecroppers. They were basically just kulaks like they have in the Georgian plains in Russia. They worked like slaves. They worked from can to can, and you didn't go and take a bath every single night. I mean, that's a relatively new thing, at least in my family. They grew up. You can't imagine how hard, but they were racist, though, Gene. But anyway, with that, we're going to shut the hell up. Gene is our resident. Gene is our resident racist. I mean, our resident Confederate history expert.
To me is not an insult. You know, if you recognize the race differences, and you know, you comment on them, that's what they always raise in hell about American Renaissance, that they talk about the differences, and. You know, not really a slam. It's just here's factual information on the difference in intelligence, difference in history, difference in culture. You know, there is a difference. And a lot of people say, oh, no, it's all the same. It's all the same. No, it's not all the same. And you look at, you know, what comes out of Africa, where they're living in huts that made out of elephant dung and, you know, tree limbs and bamboo. And then you look at modern civilization of Western Europe that came out of Western Europe and settled this continent over here. So no, it's not the same. There is a difference. And like you were talking about, there was a time in this country where, you know, it was hard living. We found that out when the power went out at Sunday morning about 5:02. That's when the clock on the radio conked out and I saw the transformer popping outside and the lights flickering. You thought, okay, we can handle it. We got a fireplace, a regular fireplace here, and we'll just sit in front of the fireplace. It'll only be out a few hours, and we'll get it back on. No. All day that Sunday night. The bad thing about it is that people don't realize you have to stay awake at night because about every hour you have to put wood back on the fire, so it's hard to get a good night's sleep. So after that Sunday, and then they were predicting 1 degree Monday night, we said, I think we're – We've done enough of this Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone stuff. My daughter and her husband had a generator, so we cleaned out all the food out of our refrigerator and took it over to their house. So from Sunday till Friday, we didn't have any power here. So I'd come back over and turn on the sinks and drip a little water out so our pipes wouldn't break. So we dodged that bullet. And then I got our bill from Nashville Electric Company. I'm going to send them a nasty note back with the check about what a sorry job they did of keeping the trees cut and all the trees coming down. And not only were they coming down, a lot of these big trees are coming down and taking down the power poles. So they not only had to rewire them, they had to get an auger out there and drill holes and put up new power poles and then rewire it. So anyway, definitely we got a taste of what it's like to live without the modern conveniences there for a week. That's for sure.
You know, Gene, you said something on a previous broadcast. I'll make this quick. That people like my my grandparents on my dad's on my mother's side, that one time several generations ago, they had land in Arkansas. But you made the point is, after Lincoln's war against the South, they were people like my grandparents, great grandparents were dispossessed of the land. They were their land was taken away from them, and that's
absolutely
how we got sharecroppers like my grandparents. But go ahead, Gene. I mean,
no, that's what they did. They turned the whites in the South into slaves to work for these big corporations from up in the Northeast and the North. They could come in and buy up hundreds of thousands of acres of timberland, of farmland, and they didn't care about the land. All they wanted was the money, and that's why they would plant crops right up to the front porch of these people's homes and plant the same crop over and over and over again that just wore out the land. And it didn't bother anybody in New York, you know, so what? But before this happened, people in the South understood you rotated your crops or you left a field fallow or unused for a year and let the soil rebuild itself. But when these large agribusinesses and land corporations came in and gobbled up all this land, they didn't care. They just wanted as much money as they could make off of this land and use these Southerners as their slave population, basically, just to go out there and work themselves to death, just about. So, and that's one reason why the Lincoln's party, the Radical Republican Party, was so hated in the South. It's not only the war, but what they did to the Southern population after the war. And I remember this as a little boy in the 50s and 60s. The only election that counted in Tennessee was the Democratic primary. And the Republicans wouldn't even run somebody. It was a waste of time. The only votes you're going to get was your mom and dad and maybe your brother and sister, but that was it. And we occasionally would have a Republican in the House of Representatives, but that was always from East Tennessee. But Middle Tennessee and West Tennessee, it was always the Democratic primary was the only one that counted, and Republicans never ran or hardly ever ran anybody in the general election. But that was a kickback or a retaliation against the Republicans and what the Radical Republican Party and what they had done to the South, not only during the war but after the war. So back then, the Republican Party was a crazy wacko party. They would have had Chuck Schumer and AOC and Bernie Sanders, and all of them would have been Republicans back then. And the Democrats were the conservative party. And of course, that changed with the Kennedys and Lyon, Lyndon Johnson when they came along. They flipped that over. So anyway, a little current events history and family history there. We usually try to get information out to our listeners that coincides with the month that we're in, and we're just about to wind up the month of February. So I thought tonight we might talk about some Confederate events that happened during the month of February, mainly about the formation of the Confederate States of America, which took place in February of 1861. Now, February wasn't a really good month for us out here in the Western theater of the war. The Eastern theater of the war was confined to Virginia and the Carolinas and over there, but over the mountains, they referred to the battles that were fought in Kentucky, Tennessee, Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia as the Western theater. So in February of 1862, we lost Fort Henry on the Tennessee River, and we lost Fort Donelson on the Cumberland River, and when Fort Donelson fell to the Axis of Evil Empire, the federal gunboats came right up the Cumberland River and into Nashville, and then the Confederates had to evacuate. Albert Sidney Johnston evacuated out of Bowling Green, Kentucky, and through Nashville, and headed back down to Murfreesboro in Middle Tennessee. They never even tried to defend Nashville. There were no defenses built around Nashville because we thought these forts were going to stop whatever was coming, and they didn't. And so Nashville was just an open city, and it fell to the enemy in February of 1862 and was occupied by the Yankee Army all the way through the war, and it was a brutal occupation. They had a big thing on TV here about they want to rebuild Fort Negley, which is a Civil War fort that's still standing there. And, you know, the people of Nashville hated the darn thing. It's like the Bastille to the French because it was built up on a hill that they used to use for picnics in the summertime. Well, we'll explain a little bit more after that, after the break there. I hear our music, and we'll take these few words, and then we'll be back. We'll get into it.
Get ready to be part of something incredible. We're breaking barriers and delivering the powerful stories that mainstream media won't touch. Your support is what fuels our mission to revolutionize journalism and bring you the truth. Join our passionate community of changemakers by donating at libertynewsradio.com today. Together, we're creating the future of news.
This is Michael Hill, Chief of the League of the South. I listen to Blood River Radio, and you should too. In fact, you should be telling your friends, your family, and your associates to listen to Eddie Miller and the good folks at Blood River Radio. They stand resolutely for the preservation of white civilization, what we once called Christendom, and they stand against the ongoing campaign of white genocide. In these trying and uncertain times, it's more important than ever to speak and act in defense of our God, our people, and our civilization. Blood River Radio speaks the truth and speaks it boldly. I've been on this show many times as a guest, and I'm very proud of my association with you. May our just cause prevail. Hail victory.
Do you know what is great about America? Ask an immigrant. Ask an Immigrant is a new podcast dedicated to helping Americans, especially our youth, value, appreciate, and be grateful for the freedoms we have here in America. Join host Lydia Wallace Nuttall as she interviews immigrants from around the world to discover their inspiring personal stories about why they came to America. To learn more about why America is the most prosperous, greatest country in the world, download the Loving Liberty app or go to lovingliberty.net.
Let me tell you something, boy. If I did give you power, you got nothing. Nobody gives you power. Real power is something you take.
Dear Blood River Radio family, I'm so excited to have Gene on here. I was going to ask him a question, but he's going to look it up. He's talking about the fall of Nashville. I asked him, how long did Memphis hold out? But, you know, sadly, we didn't hold out that long at all. I don't know. I probably should ask Gene this question over there. But I would just guess maybe because the Confederacy didn't have a navy. It takes a hell of a lot of money to build ships. I'm just thinking maybe we didn't have the navy to stop the Union Navy from coming up to Mississippi River. I don't know. Maybe that's something Gene can tackle at another time. But go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead, Peter Ender.
Okay. Well, we were talking about the month of February, and we talked about a bad month for the Confederacy out here in the West in February of 1862. We're going to jump back a year to February of 1861 and talk about the formation of the Confederate government. With the election of the radical Republican Abraham Lincoln and his party, the state of South Carolina decided that's it. They've sent crazy people down here to try to kill us and start a slave insurrection. They've put higher taxes on agricultural states and tariffs on imports to keep us from importing items from Europe and forcing us to buy from the Northeast, the industrial factories and services from the Northeast. They said, and Lincoln and the radical Republicans said, that's pretty much the end of it. We're out of here. So December 20th of 1860, South Carolina voted, their South Carolina Secession Convention voted unanimously to leave the Union. And they issued a documentation that said, you know, the agreement between South Carolina and the United States has ended. So then in January of 1861, here's the thing. Lincoln was so unpopular that he only got 39% of the vote in the 1860 presidential election. That's one reason why it forced South Carolina out. It looked like that the voting was going to be controlled in the electoral college by the Northeast, and they had enough electoral votes. It didn't matter how the rest of the country voted. They were going to put this radical wacko Republican in there. And Lincoln was so despised and hated in the South, he could not even get enough signatures to get on the ballot in seven states. You have to have a certain number of signatures if you're running Republican, Democrat, Socialist, Green Party, whatever it is, just to get on the ballot. Well, he couldn't even get enough signatures to get on the ballot. I heard some of our so-called history experts on Fox News were bad-mouthing the South, and they said, well, they kicked the Republican Party candidate Abraham Lincoln off the ballot. No, they didn't kick him off the ballot. He just couldn't even get enough signatures to get on the ballot. There's a big difference in that. So anyway, Lincoln won. The seven states in the South, it wasn't even on the ballot. And they go, good night. What kind of a country are we living in now? They can put this nutcase in there. We're out of here. So South Carolina, in December of 1860, seceded. In January of 1861, six more states voted to leave the Union. And then in February, you had representatives from the seven seceded states met at the Capitol building in Montgomery, Alabama. On February the 4th, they adopted a provisional constitution. So it actually was better than the U.S. Constitution that we have today, not necessarily because Southerners wrote it, but because Southerners had written the first one as well. But they had 80 years to look back at the old one and say, you know, that was a good idea on paper, but it just didn't work out. And if you've never read the Confederate Constitution, it's really an interesting document. First of all, they defined we the people. And the preamble to the U.S. Constitution starts off, we the people in order to form a more perfect union, et cetera, et cetera. So the government has often said the federal government is the people, and they can do pretty much what they want to because they claim that they are the people and the will of the people in this country, which they're not on many occasions. But you go back to the Constitution, it says we the people in order to form a more perfect union, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the preamble to the Confederate Constitution said we, the representatives of the several states assembled here, do ordain in this Constitution, because they wanted to put the emphasis on the states and not a central government. And the central government can define who we the people are, and they have many times over said, well, it's not just actually Eddie and Jean and Monica and all these people out there. It's the federal government that decides what's best for everybody. So that was a bad mistake on the original Constitution to never define the powers of the federal government. And even though where they did, it's been ignored. So the Confederate Constitution said, we, the representatives of the several states assembled, do hereby ordain and establish this Constitution. Had quite a few differences in the, most of it was pretty much like the U.S. Constitution, but there were some really interesting changes they made. First of all, they looked at the office of president. And they said, you know, this guy spends his last 2 years in office campaigning for the next four. We'll fix that. They gave the president of the Confederate States of America a six-year term. But you could only be president once. So, Bubba, you don't get a second chance. You better get it right the first time around. Now, they did give the president a byline veto, which a lot of presidents have asked for. And, of course, Congress will never give them that because they could go through on an appropriations bill and say, okay, we need this money for the military. We need this money for repairing harbors and things like that. We're not going to pay for the Senator Jackass Fogbound Memorial Outhouse, and that's been included in this bill. I'm going to veto that right there. Now, it can be brought back to Congress, and whoever put that in there is going to have to stand up in Congress on a separate bill by itself and explain to Congress why the taxpayers of America are going to have to fork over money to build the Senator Jackass Fogbound Memorial Outhouse. It's going to have to stand on its own 2 feet. It can't be stuck in and hidden in an appropriations bill. They had a balanced budget part of the article in the Constitution. You could not go over the budget except in national emergencies, and that had to be declared by Congress. It couldn't be a president saying, okay, we're going to go over the budget because I needed the presidential library to be built for me after I get out of office. It had to be passed on by Congress. One thing the Confederate Constitution did, it addressed the issue of slavery, which the U.S. Congress never did. They just kept the president and the Congress and the Constitution, well, never addressed it in the Constitution. So the president of the United States and Congress kept kicking the issue down the road, kept kicking the can, so to speak. Hopefully the next president will figure out what to do, or the next Congress or somebody, and they never did, and it got to a crisis situation here. So what the Confederate Constitution said was that slavery would be decided by the states or by a new territory that was requesting admission as a new state into the Confederate States of America. So they said, you know, if the existing states or a new territory wanted to have slavery, that was up to the state. If they wanted to get rid of it, that was fine, but that was up to the state. But it was not going to be a decision that was made by the federal government or the central government. Another thing they did in the Confederate Constitution was the fact that they gave the president, vice president, most of the major political officers, and most of the rank above general in the Confederate military, they were provisional. So Jefferson Davis, for his first year, was provisional president of the Confederate States of America. The vice president that they selected, Alexander Stevens, was provisional vice president. And you see a lot of these military records that General so-and-so was provisional general for 1 year. The reason was they wanted to give him a chance to see what they could do as president or as a general officer in the military. And they didn't want to have to go through impeachment to get rid of this person if he was a disaster as a president or vice president or whatever political office he had, or to have to go through a court-martial to get rid of this person as a military officer. So everybody that rank for the upper echelon in the Confederate government and the military, even Robert E. Lee, was provisional for 1 year. And at the end of 1 year, their term was up. And whether they'd been good, bad, or indifferent, their term was up after 1 year. And if they'd done a good job, then they went on to, Davis went on to his 6-year term, or the military officer was given their commission for the duration of the war. So that way they could say, well, you know, we commissioned this guy as a colonel or a general, really didn't cut it. We think maybe he'd be better managing the button-making factory in Valdosta, Georgia, than actually commanding troops out in the field. So you didn't have to have any kind of formal, attempt to have the person removed like a court-martial or something like that. So Jefferson Davis was elected provisional president on February 5th, 1861. He was sworn into office on the 18th of February. He was selected by the Confederate Congress meeting in Montgomery almost as an afterthought. There were several people that were suggested for president, and they picked Davis because he had had military experience. He'd been Secretary of War in the United States government. He was a senator from Mississippi. He's fairly well known. And there were a lot of people that said he probably was on the road to become president of the United States because of his military experience and the experience he had in the United States Congress. But he was at home in Mississippi, and somebody sent him a message that said, oh, by the way, you've been elected president of this new Confederate States of America. And so he had to travel from Mississippi over to Montgomery to accept the office of president of the Confederate States of America. We'll get into some more detail after the break.
Hang on, folks. You got plenty of time to go get some coffee. Be right back, folks.
Thank you. protecting your liberties. You're listening to Liberty News Radio.
News this hour from Town Hall, I'm Mary Rose. President Trump has warned that limited strikes against Iran are possible, even as the country's top diplomat says Tehran expects to have a proposed deal ready in the next few days. Military affairs analyst, retired Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis, doubts that the current negotiations will result in Iranian nuclear disarmament.
Will the Iranians give up their nuclear program? No. Just like the Libyans gave up theirs and crumbled, North Koreans didn't and survived, and I think they've gone to school on that. Plus, the Iranians have the support of the Chinese and the Russians, albeit, you know, somewhat of an at arm's length.
The president says if Iran fails to comply with U.S. demands within 10 days, bad things will happen. Senator Tom Cotton says Iran should accept U.S. demands.
These are pretty reasonable requests by the United States and by Israel, that Iran no longer export terror and violence and chaos. But, of course, they've been doing that for 47 years. So color me skeptical about their willingness to change their spot at this late hour.
Economist Steve Moore applauds President Trump's economic policies.
We want to be a nation of capitalists, which, by the way, is one of the reasons I really like this idea of the Trump accounts, where now a newborn baby will actually own a piece of America. And as the stock market goes up, their wealth will go up. We could have, you know, people 25 years from now who are just youngsters today being millionaires.
Moore made his comments to the Salem Radio Network. The much anticipated but never guaranteed U.S.-Canada showdown for gold in men's hockey at the Olympics is on. Jack Hughes scored two goals, including one with a highlight reel individual effort. More on these stories at townhall.com.
In today's fast-paced world, professionals face endless projects, deadlines, competition. To thrive, you need mental clarity, sharp focus, and reliable memory. That's why the same company that brings you Relief Factor created ThinkFactor. ThinkFactor is designed to help you think clearer and perform better daily. It's a powerful blend of nutrients that supercharges your memory and sharpens your focus. You can stay on top of your work and outshine the competition. After a couple of weeks of taking ThinkFactor, I noticed a dramatic difference in my clarity, my focus, even my memory. And you know what? But the longer you take ThinkFactor, the better the results are. If you've ever felt mentally foggy or struggled to keep up with everything on your plate, well, ThinkFactor can help you reclaim your cognitive edge and thrive in your life. Call 800-4-RELIEF, 800-4-RELIEF, or visit ReliefFactor.com, ReliefFactor.com, to order ThinkFactor. Call 800-4-RELIEF or visit ReliefFactor.com. Your first bottle, just $19.95. ThinkFactor. Think clearer, perform better daily.
I'm Pastor Everett Ramsey, pastor of Faith Baptist Church, a congregation of God's covenant people. Informed Christians know that we are at the brink of a long-planned one-world government being executed that will not tolerate true Christian faith. There is a way to stop it. Our church has used God's spiritual weapons of warfare many times over the years, and in every case that was properly executed, the Church of Jesus Christ had been delivered. It is called the Court of Divine Justice. David used it many times. Read Psalm 37, Psalm 109. It includes truthful information, repentance, and imprecatory prayers. Blood River Radio is the only radio station I know that supports action based on truth about lies concerning the Confederacy, the Civil Rights Movement, the German people, the true Holocaust, and who the true covenant people of God are, and the sins and failures of the churches, if any of these. This means anything to you, and it should, then please say so with your money, as well as prayers. You may obtain information from us about the Courts of Divine Justice by sending your offering and request to Blood River Radio, and we take none of the money.
In the medical field, IT security is crucial. Our highly skilled consultants are HIPAA certified and have 20 plus years of experience servicing medical clinics, billing and supply companies. We offer comprehensive endpoint protection, guarding your computers and servers against all stages of threats. And with our 24/7 monitoring services, you'll never worry about extensive downtime again. Ready to level up your IT support? Call 801-706-6980 today and discover how great IT services can be with Managed IT Services.
Step into the boots of the American West with Range Magazine, where grit meets grace. This is a front row seat to the stories, struggles, and triumphs of ranchers, farmers, and stewards of the land. From jaw-dropping photography to no-nonsense reporting, Range brings you the untold tales of life on the range. Whether you're a city dweller with a cowboy's heart or living life where the pavement ends, Range speaks to the soul of the West. Subscribe today at rangemagazine.com.
Smell of napalm in the morning. Smells like victory.
Some folks are born made to wave the flag.
Dear Blood River Radio family, I wish y'all could hear some of the conversations we have during the break sometimes. One of these days, me and Gene will have to do a special on General Patton. And what I was just saying, how I believe the tail gunner Joe McCarthy, who said talked about how many communists were infiltrated into the State Department, I think he greatly underestimated them. I think it's my belief. I think Eisenhower was a communist myself. I know he loved Uncle Joe Stalin and he worshipped General Zhukov in the Soviet Union. But I just want y'all to know we talk about some wire things here to break sometimes. Anyway, don't want to interrupt what you were talking about, Gene.
I want to go back. That girl told me she was over 18 years of old. 18 years old. That's what we were talking about in the break.
Yeah, I'll swear to it.
No, we don't talk about that. We don't. We're not on the Jeffrey Epstein Island or anything like that. That was
that's right.
Something that didn't come up at all. We were talking about the beginning of the Confederate States government in Montgomery, Alabama, in February of 1861. They selected Jefferson Davis for president on February 5th. He was informed at his farm over in Mississippi that he'd been elected president and he hadn't run for it. And they didn't do that much back then. Back then and up through probably the 1870s, it was considered very in bad taste if a presidential candidate went out and campaigned for office. You had other people that did that. The high school I went to in Nashville was John Overton High School, and John Overton was a friend of Andrew Jackson, and he was the one that campaigned for Andrew Jackson to become president, and he was sort of his campaign manager. But Jackson, it was, you know, considered in poor taste for the candidate to go out and campaign for the office of president or something. You had other people that did that for you. So the same thing happened here. Jefferson Davis had resigned from the United States Senate after Mississippi seceded. He went home to his farm, Briarfield, in Mississippi, and wanted to join the Confederacy as an officer because he had served in the United States military and then Secretary of War. And that was what he thought his best skill that he could offer the Confederacy was as an officer. And then all of a sudden he found out that the Confederate Congress had selected him as president. So it took him from February 5th to get to Montgomery until about the 18th, because there was no direct rail connection between where he was in Mississippi and all the way over to Montgomery, Alabama, in the next state. So that didn't bode very well for the Confederacy during the war to try to move troops from one threatened area to another. Most of the rail lines were running north and south and instead of east and west. So that was a problem we found out in the war. It came back to haunt us. So after he was sworn in as president, he announced his secretaries of his cabinet, and would like to go over just a few of them and tell you what these people did. One of them was Stephen Mallory, and Stephen Mallory had been a senator, a United States senator from Florida in the U.S. Congress, and he was chairman of the Department of Naval Affairs in the United States Congress. So Jefferson Davis asked him if he would serve as Secretary of the Navy, which he did, which was kind of nice title, but he had no Navy. There was no Navy in the Confederate States of America. So everything Stephen Mallory did, he had to build from scratch. So they didn't have any tradition to fall back on it. And while he was in the United States Senate in the Department of Naval Affairs, he tried to get the U.S. Congress to provide money to build ironclad ships, because he said England and France are building ironclad ships, and if we get in another war, that's what we're going to have to fight against. And we've got all these wooden hull sailing ships that an ironclad ship will just tear it to pieces. And the traditionalists in the Navy said, oh, no way, no way. Nothing can stop the frigates that we have in the United States Navy. So since the Confederate Navy had no tradition to fall back on, they started building all of these ironclad ships. And, of course, probably the most famous one was the one that Stephen Mallory had built over the hull of the USS Merrimack at the Gosport Navy Yard in Norfolk, Virginia. And, of course, it went out in March of 1862 and destroyed three of the modern frigates that Stephen Mallory had begged the United States Navy to build while he was in the United States Congress. So in one morning, this ironclad ship that they didn't want to have anything to do with took out three of the six modern frigates that he had begged and begged and pleaded with the United States Navy to build. The Confederate States Navy has always looked down as so inferior to the United States Navy. But if you look at the whole department of the Navy, which meant the surface ships, it meant the torpedo department, or we call them mines today, but there were torpedoes back then. If you consider the Navy personnel that manned the coastal forts like at Savannah and Charleston, Mobile, all of these places, and the Confederate submarine service, which was, they had small submarines. They built the David. The most famous one, of course, was the Hunley that sank a U.S. warship out in the harbor at Charleston in February of 1864, which is the first submarine to sink an enemy warship. But if you add all that together, the Confederate States Navy destroyed more United States naval ships than the entire history of the United States Navy from 1775 up until the morning of December 7th, 1941. So the Confederate Navy took out more U.S. warships.
That's amazing.
Than the entire history of the United States Navy up until the morning of December 7th. Of course, the Japanese took out a lot more than the Confederates did. But, yeah, they never had a Navy. They couldn't completely break the blockade that the United States Navy put around the southern ports to starve the Southerners out and force them to surrender. And a lot of these ironclads that they built, and I need to go back. I've got a book over there. I'm looking at it on the shelf right now in the history of the Confederate States Navy, and count up how many ironclads the Confederates actually built during the course of the war. And they had them in Mobile, in Savannah, in Wilmington, North Carolina, and of course in Charleston, and quite a few of these port cities. I think, just roughly looking at or remembering the ones they had, there were probably about 20 of them that they were built from basically nothing, from scratch. And only one of them, those 20 or whatever it was, only one was actually defeated in a naval battle. And that was a poor old CSS Tennessee in the Battle at Mobile Bay. It fought against 19 federal warships.
Damn.
And finally, it was just literally shot to pieces. A bad design. They ran the chains for the rudder across the stern deck, and once those chains were shot away, then it couldn't turn and maneuver. So now it was just sitting out in the harbor, and they had 19 ships going around and around it, just blasting it to pieces. So Stephen Mallory did a really good job of building the Navy from nothing. Another member of his cabinet was Judah P. Benjamin from Louisiana, from New Orleans. Very adept lawyer, and he was selected as Attorney General on the cabinet. And then he was moved to Secretary of War, which was kind of a dead-end job in the Confederate government because as more and more territory was lost, it was blamed on the Secretary of War. And then they moved Benjamin to Secretary of State, which was really his best position for the Confederate government. He went to Europe and, along with James Bullock, got several deals with the British government to buy these state-of-the-art sailing ships that had three masts, but they also had steam engines in them. That was sort of the state-of-the-art ship of that day. So if there wasn't any wind, or if you were trying to negotiate through a real dangerous channel to get into a harbor, you could furl the sails and use the steam power to get in there. And these ships then were converted into warships. They took them outside of British waters since they were supposed to be neutral. But the Brits didn't care. They were selling to both sides, north and south. They thought it was great, and they were hoping the Yanks would kill about a million of each other over there and pay them back for ducking out on their empire. So anyway, they would take them down, usually down to the Azores, and then arm them as warships and use them as commerce raiders. Now, these weren't warships to fight against the Federal Navy, but they went after U.S. merchant ships all over the world. And the most famous, of course, was the CSS Alabama, and Shenandoah, the Sumter, the Nashville, the Tallahassee, the Florida. And all of these ships really crippled the United States merchant marine. By 1864, no foreign country would ship a cargo on a U.S. ship because they couldn't get insurance for it. Because they knew the insurance companies that the Alabama, the Shenandoah, these commerce raiders were out there, and they would the Alabama under Admiral Raphael Sims captured and destroyed 69 U.S. merchant ships in its two-year history, and they had to destroy them because they couldn't take them back to a southern port because of the blockade. They couldn't sell them to a foreign country because the U.S. government would threaten France or England or Spain or whoever if they bought one of these ships, and they would lose their trade with the U.S., which they needed the grain from the U.S. So they had to just either burn them, or after about four or five captures, they'd put all the civilians on one ship and turn them loose and go on after the rest of them. We'll wind it up after the break.
Yes, sir. I can't wait. I know we're up. Family can't wait either, Gene. Be right back.
Please. Are you ready to stand up for your community and support your local sheriff? Join the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association and become a vital member of the Sheriff's Citizens Posse. At CSPOA.org, we empower citizens like you through weekly webinars, arming you with the knowledge to back your constitutional county sheriff. Together, we can uphold our Constitution and ensure liberty and justice for all. Your community needs you now more than ever.
I'm Monica Schaefer from Canada, a former political prisoner. Here at Blood River Radio, we are not afraid to tell the truth and shame the devil. Our mission is to fight against white genocide. We do that by exposing the lies. We talk about the American Civil War. We talk about the vilification of German people and, by extension, all white people. And we even talk about that linchpin lie, the Holocaust. Deception by the alien enemy within has brought us whites to our knees. My last words at the Schaefer's speech crime trial in Germany were, quote, "If there was a law forbidding us to breathe, we would break that law immediately just to live. And so it is with this law. We must break this law in order to survive and thrive as a people." Unquote. Please donate to Blood River Radio and help keep us on the air.
This is a battle between truth and deceit, a battle between forces that would enslave this country in darkness and between a media that wants to present you with the truth.
We are being censored. America's news outlets no longer provide the truth. 90% of news outlets in the United States are controlled by six corporations. The mission of the Epoch Times is to chase the truth, to ground all statements in fact.
TheEpochTimes.com.
Dear Blood River family, this has been a fabulous educational hour. But without further ado, I don't want to interrupt Gene anymore, but he just told us a very interesting tidbit of history during the hour. If he has time, maybe he can repeat to y'all what he just told me. Go ahead, Gene.
Okay. The whole point of these commerce raiders was not to attack the Federal Navy. It was to put such a hurting on the United States economy that these northern businessmen and ship owners up in the Northeast would put a pressure on Lincoln to not to surrender, but just to say, okay, this is costing too much in money, costing too many lives. Let the southern states go. They're backward. They're inbred. They're horrible people. We don't want them in the United States anyway. Just let them go. Let's say thank you. You can call us whatever names you want to, as long as we're out of here. Or bring ships off of the blockade to try to hunt down the Alabama or the Shenandoah. And it was a world war. The Alabama sank U.S. ships in the Gulf, in the North and South Atlantic. The Shenandoah circled the entire globe. It was built in London, armed at the Azores and the Atlantic, went down across the Indian Ocean. They picked up Marines, Australian Marines, and used them on this Confederate ship and went up into the Bering Sea and went to attack the U.S. whaling fleet up there. Of course, they used whale oil for lamps back then. They destroyed the United States whaling industry in the Bering Sea. They sank every whaling ship that was up there. So I guess you could say that the Confederates were the first ecologists. They were out saving the whale before it was the end thing to do.
Yeah.
And then they were headed down. There were no other ships for them to destroy up there. They destroyed the entire Yankee whaling fleet. So they were coming down across the Pacific. They were going to raid San Francisco. And they stopped a British ship out on the high seas to make sure it was actually a British ship, not just a Yankee ship flying a British flag. And it was a British ship. And they said, well, we're sorry, mates. Your war has been over for about 3 months. Well, of course, they had no way of getting CNN or Fox News or anything up in the Bering Sea. They didn't know it. So they called off the raid on San Francisco, dumped their cannons overboard so they wouldn't be considered a pirate ship, sailed on down the west coast of the United States, South America, rounded the Horn, and came back up the Atlantic, recrossed the equator, and brought the ship back into its home port of Liverpool, England, on the Mercy, and dropped anchor on the Mercy River and surrendered the last official Confederate flag to the British government in November of 1865. So that's what Stephen Mallory and Judah P. Benjamin and James Bullock had gotten going for the Confederate Navy. One other cabinet member I'd like to talk about, John Regan, from Texas. Now, he was originally from Gatlinburg, Tennessee, and they used to have a sign up there about John Regan, and he was Postmaster General of the Confederacy. But they've moved the sign back off the main street there in Gatlinburg and kind of put it back in a little park where most people can't see it. You know, they don't want to upset the tourists coming down there to Gatlinburg. And but he was Postmaster General. And the Confederate States Post Office was never in debt. It never raised the price of postage stamps, and it never went to Congress for a bailout like our post office always does today. A couple of interesting things about Stephen Mallory and Judah P. Benjamin. Mallory was from Pensacola, Florida, and he was Catholic, and Judah P. Benjamin was Jewish. Lincoln did not want Jews or Catholics serving in any high government position in the United States cabinet or in his political offices around there. They didn't want Jews or Catholics serving. So you had Stephen Mallory, Catholic, and Judah P. Benjamin, who was Jewish, that served their whole careers in the Confederate States government, and they were highly respected. In fact, Judah P. Benjamin, they called him the brains of the Confederacy. He was that smart on a lot of the things he came up with, especially when he went to Europe and negotiated all these deals for these ships. Okay, one other thing the Confederates did at this conference, they appointed a flag committee at the convention in Montgomery to come up with a flag for the new country. And they opened it up to people all over the South to send in their suggestions. And some of them were pretty good, some of them not so good. I've seen some of them. There was one that had palm trees and fish jumping out of the water and the sunset on it. I think that was one of those things where they say, thank you very much for your effort, but don't call us, we'll call you. William Porcher Miles of South Carolina came up with a design for a red flag and a blue diagonal cross on it. And it was called the Southern Cross. It was called the Celtic Cross or the Cross of St. Andrew because Andrew, if you remember, had been crucified on a diagonal cross, and that was his proposal. And it was given to the flag committee, and it was turned down because when they were hanging these several that they had cut down to the final four, the Sweet 16 or whatever it was, they were hanging them up in the Senate chamber in the Capitol in Montgomery, but they're hanging them vertically. And one of the senators saw this flag, and he said, well, I'll tell you, I ain't vote for no flag. It looks like a pair of suspenders hanging up there. So it got the axe. And one of the main reasons it got the axe was they only had seven states, so it's hard to balance seven stars on four arms of a flag. Now, the flag they did come up with was the first national flag of the Confederacy. It was referred to as the Stars and Bars. And it was a flag that had a blue canton up in the left corner and a circle of stars, seven stars at this time. So the circle of seven stars could be expanded to 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 eventually, and then had a red stripe and a white stripe and a red stripe horizontally on the flag. So this was referred to as the Stars and Bars. And you can tell if the prostitutes in the media know absolutely nothing about the South. They put up a picture of our battle flag, which is a red flag and the blue diagonal crosses on it. And they said, well, there's controversy about the Stars and Bars, details at 6. Well, obviously, they don't know what they're talking about. That's not the Stars and Bars. They never put up the First National flag. Now, it worked fine for a while when it was flying over the post office or the government building. The problem they ran into with that First National flag was when they got on the battlefield, the first big battle of the war at Manassas, Virginia, in July of 1861, when a flag like that was hanging limp on a flagpole with all the smoke and dust on the battlefield, you had the blue Canton in the corner and a red and white, and it looked too much like the U.S. flag. So they said, okay, we'll keep that as the government flag. For the military, we'll go back to that flag that Mr. Miles came up with, the red flag with the blue diagonal cross on it. And now, by the time they got to Manassas, there were 13 states that voted to leave the Union. So now you had 13 stars, three on each arm of the flag and then one in the middle. So that was easy to balance that out. And there was no doubt about that flag being completely different from the U.S. flag out on the battlefield. So anyway, that's where the Confederate flag came from the Flag Committee in Montgomery. They also came up with a seal, the Great Seal of the Confederate States of America. And it was entirely different from the U.S. seal. It has the buzzards holding on to the arrows and then the Yankee seal on there with the stars and the red and white stripes and all that nonsense. Anyway, the Confederate seal in the center of it had a reproduction of the George Washington statue on the Capitol grounds in Richmond. And he was looked upon as the father of our country, of course. And it was adopted on February 22nd, 1862, the same time that we went from the provisional government into the regular government. So on the Confederate seal, it has 22 February 1862, and of course February 22nd was also George Washington's birthday, so they wanted a lot of that to be tied together. And then the motto underneath that, the Latin motto, was Deo Vindici, God vindicates. Like on the U.S. seal, it says E Pluribus Unum, out of many one. So our motto was Deo Vindici, God vindicates. And then in the circle around the picture or the etching of George Washington there, they had the various plants of the South that were used here for commerce. They had a cotton plant, sugar cane, and then the leaves, the flowers from the tobacco plant. So that was the Confederate seal. Now, what happened was that was all taken care of. The Confederates then Lincoln said, and he said it to his cabinet and anybody that was listening in the North, that Southern states weren't going to come back on their own. They had their own government set up. They had their own military set up. They were building the Navy. So Lincoln said he needed a war, and he needed to goad the South into firing the first shot to get the sentiment of the North and all the political leaders in the North and the general population in the North all fired up to fight against the Confederacy and force them back into the Union. I've often wondered and have gotten into arguments with some of these so-called real conservative people. How can the United States of America be such a great country if you have to force people to be a part of it at the point of a gun?
Bingo.
If it were that great, why wouldn't people want to be a part of it? Why, if people want to just simply leave? And the thing was, the misconception was the war that was fought was called a civil war, and it wasn't. There was no attempt by the Confederate States of America to overthrow the government of the United States, and that's what a civil war is. You have, any dictionary will give you this definition, it's a war fought between two factions within a country. Well, that's wrong. The United States invaded another country, Confederate States of America, and for the control of the government. Well, we never wanted to control the U.S. government. So anyway, Lincoln made an issue out of Fort Sumter in Charleston, South Carolina, got his war, and we are forced to be a part of the United States. So, Eddie, thank you for the time. I hope our listeners learned a little bit about the history of the formation of the Confederate States of America.
Well, the gratitude is mine. Thank you so much, Bitterinder. Thank you so much, Gene. You did a marvelous job. I always learn something every single week when you do this. It's just I'm sure that our family, Blood River Radio family, enjoys your program and gets a lot out of it. And I'd just like to say one more time, we had to cancel our April 9, 10, 11 Columbia event. So sorry we had to do it, but we had to do it. Well, good night, everybody.